Okay, so in today's episode, we have Joe Lando Lena here. And most people might know Joe because he's been around for quite a while now. I mean, there's even a TEDx that I saw of you from 2014. And I think I came across this video a while ago before I started biomedical engineering. But when I was preparing for this episode, I rewatched it again. So Joe is basically the CEO of Creslon, which is sort of like a medical technology, or they call it biotech, some people, but I would like to call it a medical technology company that makes a gel that prevents blood loss, basically. And this is based on several exciting compounds and everything. And the story of how Joe started to get to this point is quite exciting. So yeah, before I even get started, I'm just honored to have you on the podcast, Joe. It's really an honor, and welcome to MedTech 101.
Of course, Rodney. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, so just getting started then with the TEDx talk that I referenced in 2014. I think by that time you're already 22, you'd already been working on the gel. Was it the Veti gel or was it a different gel at the time that you're working on? And just to paint the picture, the Veti gel is the gel that you guys designed or that you invented when you're 17. And you're selling it commercially right now for veterinary use. So that's for use in, you know, animals. But just fast forwarding back. Well, I don't know if it's fast forwarding or going back to 2014, because you'd already been doing it really well by then. So looking at the TED Talk, Joe, how did you get there? Did you start there?
Definitely. I was very lucky. I got a very early start into everything. And to my grandfather was also in the biotech industry. He was an executive for Hoffmann La Roche for years. And in retirement, he started a vineyard, which meant that there was a winery laboratory across the street from my house. And so the day that I learned how to walk, I learned how to go and do lab research. And it may not have been as fancy or as sophisticated as some of the work that's done at top tier universities or what we're even doing today at Creslon. But it was enough to get me interested. And so when I founded the company, I was 17 years old, and I was then a freshman at NYU's engineering school. And so by my senior year, which was 2014, we had built up enough notoriety where we had built a prototype of VetiGel, and we were able to show that the product could actually stop bleeding. And so that got the interest of a number of TEDx's. And so I think I've done about 3 TEDx talks and then 1 TED main stage talk as a TED fellow. And it was really an amazing experience. So in 2014, I gave a TED talk in Rio at TED Global 2014. And it really served as one of the launching pads for the company, because there's notoriety that you get within a community, within a city or within a university. And then there's having a TED talk that brings millions or tens of millions or hundreds of millions of people to your doorstep. And it really allowed us to translate the project that we had worked on through undergrad into the pathway that turned into what Creslon is today, which is a biomanufacturer with operations in 4 continents.
Nice. That's really impressive. And I have to say, I'll be putting the link of that TED Talk in the description as well for this episode. But it was quite impressive, Joe, how you spoke there. You were quite articulated. You seem to have been on top of everything. Was that confidence also coming from the belief you have in this product you guys had created, or were you just born a public speaker? What would you say?
So I think I was lucky. I was always, if you'd come to see me in grade school, I was always the narrator at the school play. So I always enjoyed public speaking. But what I'll say is that with this product, it makes it really easy to get excited about it. The concept of saving lives and the ability to be able to stop bleeding so quickly as we can with our products is so exciting that it's hard to get nervous. It's hard to deny the impact of the technology. And it makes it really easy to do things like stand up on a stage in front of a bunch of people.
That's good. And just to put this into perspective in terms of how impactful this product is, I did a bit of research, and I was reading an article that was published by the Scandinavian Journal of Trauma, Resuscitation and Emergency Medicine. And here they stated that about every single year, about 60,000 people in the US sort of like lose their lives because of blood loss, right? And globally, they estimate it to be about 1.5 million people. So that's the size of people you basically going to be impacting with this product. So I don't know if you want to just give us a quick background then in terms of like how it works, because I'm sure there's a lot of people out there who are thinking, okay, this is a life-saving product, but how could you explain that in a, you know, in a way that would make it easily understandable to a lot of people?
Of course. And so what we do with our technology is effectively we make a really good adhesive. And I'll explain exactly how it works in a second. But really what we're trying to do is create a material that will, when you flow it or deploy it onto a bleeding wound, whether that's a surgical bleed like something that you would find in neuro or spinal surgery, or it's a massive trauma resulting from a gunshot or a motor vehicle accident, you want this product to get into all of the nooks and crannies of the injury. So it'd be just flowable enough that it can fill the entire cavity, but be just strong enough that it creates a mechanical barrier against bleeding and then allows the patient to create their own clot. And that's exactly what we do. So our technology is based on two polysaccharides or long chains of sugar that are derived primarily from algae. So it's entirely plant-based. And we take these polymers and we purify them and mix them together into a pre-filled gel. And in fact, I have just a sample of it right here. And so in this little 5cc syringe, it looks almost like the consistency of hummus. And so it's this viscous paste that is completely plant-derived that when you put it onto an injury, you can't observe exactly what's happening, but the product will almost instantaneously create a mechanical seal against that bleed. And then what happens next is where we differentiate ourselves, because stopping the bleeding is all well and good, but if the patient can't have a clot of their own underneath, then when that product gets removed, the patient will rebleed. And that's obviously unacceptable. And so what we do, or what the technology does, is it allows the patient to create their own clot without becoming incorporated within the gel. And a great example of that is if you cut yourself while shaving and you put toilet paper on it, whether it's on your face or your leg or somewhere else, you put that on, it'll stop bleeding in about 7 minutes. But then if that toilet paper goes away, the clot is inside of the strands of the toilet paper, you rip the clot off and you're bleeding again. With Vetigel or with our other technologies, it allows you to remove the product without disturbing the underlying clot. Nice. And what that looks like is it takes the time to hemostasis from 5 to 7 minutes, and it shrinks that down to 2.5 seconds on average.
Well, so yeah, so I've got a few questions actually. Was this so exciting? Maybe it's because it's the engineer inside of me. But so first question, the premix that you guys make, does it come pre-mixed already, or is it something the patient or the surgeon sort of like does before they apply it?
So it was very important to us to have the premix completed without preparation for the surgeon. And so this syringe of Vetigel is just 5 milliliters of premixed gel. There's no preparation that the surgeon needs to do other than removing the syringe from the pouch and uncapping the syringe.
Well, and so then does that then prolong the shelf life, or does it then, what's the benefit besides the time it takes to use it? Does it give you guys a longer shelf life?
So it leads to better stability. And so it allows us, once you put it together, I always describe making Vetigel like making a souffle. Yeah. It's very difficult while you're making it, but if you do it perfectly at the end, yes, you have a really stable final product. Now, if it's while it's in the oven, if you look at it the wrong way, it'll collapse and you're not going to have a good time. But once it ends up in the syringe, it ends up with a very stable material that will last. Vetigel right now is shelf stable for 18 months at room temperature.
Well, that's quite impressive. And the second point you touched on was that it allows the blood to clot, right? And just to give a quick sort of like breakdown for people who don't really know how clots function, the blood is made of, you know, several components, and one of them is platelets, right? That's what they call them. So little tiny fibers in there. If you get a cut, it's sort of like they sort of join together and they stick together and they form a sort of like a seal, right, to prevent that blood loss. But in this case, what makes your gel really you know, not become adhesive to that blood clot? Do you, is it because of the from a chemical point of view, or is it just the way you have designed it so that it doesn't actually, you know, adhere to the clot itself? So when you pull it out, you're not pulling the clot, and the clot stays behind.
So it's a mix of both. So there's both in the chemistry of the gel. There's nothing that binds strongly to tissue, right, including blood, and so most of the binding, not to get too chemical or too technical here, is ionic, which means that it's effectively using little charges in the gel to stick to little charges in the patient, and so those are very easily reversible binding, as opposed to a lot of strong adhesives that use covalent bonding. Once it bonds, you're going to have a very difficult time taking it off, and so it makes it really easy. Then the second thing is that mechanically, the gel has no pores in it. And so that means that none of the fluid from the patient will be able to be absorbed by our gel, and vice versa. And as a result, any interaction happens only at the interface between the two, and not, there's no mixing of gel with blood. And because of that, it means that it's a lot easier to peel the gel away without pulling the clot off. Unlike the toilet paper example that I mentioned earlier, where the blood, the clot, any other fluid from the patient will enter the toilet paper. And so when you try to take that toilet paper away, the clot is actually tangled around fibers within the toilet paper. And so it's not as if the toilet paper is sticking to the clot per se. Sure. It's just becoming part of the clot. And when you take it off, the whole thing comes off with it.
Makes sense. And no, that's really impressive, Joe, I have to say. I'm trying to stay as composed as much as I can, you know, but from... because I work in research as well, and this kind of stuff is really fascinating. So this then brings me to the question, when you guys started working with this in animals, was that part of the strategy to sort of like slowly work your way to human use? Because I know there's some really exciting news that happened last week for you guys, but I'm going to get to that point. But for now, I just want to understand your strategy. When you started with animals, was that part of the sort of like proving the concept of the gel before you got to humans? What was the strategy behind that?
Exactly. So as we were starting Cresilon, 2012 was fairly early in our history. And for those of you who may not be locals to the New York area or the East Coast of the U.S., there was a major hurricane that hit New York at the end of 2012 called Hurricane Sandy. And it was devastating because we're up here on the East Coast. We're not used to hurricanes or massive storms like that. And there were a number of lives lost. But on top of that, there was damage to a local zoo and aquarium where there was an animal that was unable to be stopped or be saved because their bleeding couldn't be stopped, and the vet clinic had no product to be able to stop that bleeding. And so at that time, we realized that the animal health market was a viable option for us to move into. And the great thing about animal health is that it allows you to be able to trial and test out across a broad range of applications, because there's such a diversity in animal health of both species that are being treated as well as anatomies and different areas. So as an engineer, it's effectively a playground for us, where you have a market that is nearly completely open with very limited competition that works. And you get to try things out on amazing types of indications that you could never conceive of existing in the human space. And then when we get to it, it's one-for-one transferable, meaning that the learnings that we get out of animal health, we can apply directly into the human space. And so we realized that animal health would be a great first stop for our technology. And so we developed VetaGel first, and VetaGel is our broad indication surgical product for animal surgery or veterinary surgery. And that's been on the market now since 2020. And VetaGel is now sold in about 30 countries around the globe. And so it's been incredibly exciting seeing patients' lives saved with that product, and now as we get into the news of our FDA clearance for humans, it's allowing us to start to expand that mission of saving lives into humans for the first time.
And that's really impressive, Joe. And just to also look at it, to add on to the people listening, that when you start with animals, even from a regulatory affairs point of view, it's quite a good move, because it's not as high as it will be for human beings, but then it gives you the way to sort of like prove the concept. And I guess this was part of the strategy of why you used the 510K route to market for the you call it the CHG, which is the Creslon hemostatic gel, which is what we're going to be touching on now. But I mean, looking at that, like, I think you must be happy, Joe, because I mean, you've been waiting for this moment for, I don't know how many years now, 13 years. How long have you been waiting for this moment?
Well, it's been 13 years in the making, and so it's really nice to finally be able to get that clearance from FDA. Nice. But yeah, what I'll say is that CHG is Creslon hemostatic gel is our first step into humans, and so what Creslon has taken is what we call the path of least regulation, right? And the way that we look at that is using data sets that we generate that are revenue generating to defray the cost and the burden of moving into more and more difficult to enter markets. And, yes. And so animal health was a great playground or starting area for us because there's a real need and we're saving lives and we've been able to impact the lives of tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of patients already in animal health. And nice. We're making a real difference in that market and we're moving towards becoming standard of care there, which is incredibly exciting. And the great thing about animal health is that every indication that we're looking at in the human space, again, from neuro and spine surgery through to trauma to dentistry and minor bleeding like we have at CHG and everything in between, we've been piloting that in animal health in a real clinical setting in a way that actually helps patients and actually helps clinicians be able to perform medicine better. And so as we approach the human space, that allowed us to use this 510K strategy, which allows us to start with smaller indications like minor bleeding, which is the first step for CHG, and then eventually begin to expand that out, where the next stop on that train will be trauma care for gunshot wounds, stabbings, and major bleeds. And then from that point, moving into more surgical bleeds, for example, spine surgery.
No, that's really good. I think I would give you a round of applause for that work because it takes a long time to get to this point, and I'm really proud of that, and it's quite inspiring to hear that. And just for the users, but the audience listening, getting approval onto the market through the 510K is really good because it shows that the technology is well established. Otherwise, you will not get approved. So that's really good to see a product coming through that's well established in terms of technology wise, and this is going to be going to save lives. And what classification then in terms of risk? What class is this CHG going to be? Is it a class one or class two product?
So strictly speaking, external hemostatics are unclassified devices, but they're regulated as class two.
All right. So it's a bit of paperwork for your regs team. I'm sure they were excited with that clearance because it was a huge relief. And then, that's really good. I did an episode earlier just trying to discuss the different classes of medical devices. And in Europe, we have 2A, 2B. I know in the US, just class two. But nonetheless, I just want to rewind back again because your story seems like a sort of like a Facebook story. I don't know if it makes sense because you started in the dorm room as well. So it's quite important for us to touch on that, just go back to that. How did you go from your dorm room to now where you, I think your company now has got about 60 people just mainly, but I know you also have sort of like a manufacturing site, but we can talk about that as well. So how have you done that transition to this point?
Sure. I think that first things first, it was a lot of naivete that allowed us to move forward because it takes a lot of not knowing what you don't know in order to, at 17 years old, say, I'm going to forge forward with this. And so we knew it from the very beginning that we had something that really could impact lives. And it was really clear that this technology was special. And I think that that was the driving force in all of this, that it's so rare, in my opinion, in life sciences to have technology that is differentiated by multiple orders of magnitude as opposed to 10, 20, 30% better than competition. And so knowing that we were stewards of that came a responsibility of good stewardship with that technology. And what that meant was that we, through all of it, through thick and thin, there was this responsibility that we would have failed not only ourselves, but failed our patients by not being able to get this through. And so it was a very long and arduous path. And the biggest crux of that was that, unlike most biotechs or medical device companies do, Cresilon, because of the novelty of our technology, Vetigel is basically like making hummus like a vaccine. And there are lots of hummus manufacturers in the world and lots of vaccine manufacturers in the world. Yes. No one has quite been stupid enough to try to do it together. And so we were one of the first. And as a result, we could not outsource our manufacturing. We couldn't outsource a lot of our testing. We couldn't outsource our regulatory work. And so we got put in this position several times over the development of the company, where it was either shut down the business because no one else could do this for us, or learn how to do it ourselves and try to do something that no one's ever done before. And so again, I'm not sure how many of your viewers will be able to see my background here, right? But this, my background may look a little bit odd, not like an office building of a startup that's raised nearly $100 million. But this is, it's an old 1930s schoolhouse in the middle of Brooklyn that we found on Craigslist in 2013. And wow. So, I mean, this isn't where we do our manufacturing, but it's still our headquarters. And just above me today was our first pilot plant. And so, you know, we got scrappy. We found ways to get it done. We built our own clean rooms. We found labs from companies that had gone bankrupt, and we went in and we rented U-Hauls, and we pulled equipment and shelves and flooring out of the walls and off the floors and drove them here to Brooklyn, and we built our own stuff. And so in the very beginning, when we didn't have the resources to do things, quote, the right way, we were able to persevere. And then that helped us attract a great group of investors that invested over and over and over again throughout the lifespan of the company, until finally in 2015, we realized that if we were going to do this, we had to really do this the right way and bring in a world-class team and build manufacturing that was state-of-the-art. And we invested in South Brooklyn in a site called Industry City, where we built about 25,000 square feet of aseptic fill and finish manufacturing, so vaccine grade manufacturing. And today that's the only aseptic fill and finish in the five boroughs of New York. And so we're the only biomanufacturer here. And that's something that we're incredibly proud of. And as a New Yorker myself, it's great to be able to walk to work and not have to commute. And it's also great to be able to hire out of our own backyard and hire people that grew up here in the city. That New York has this big problem where we educate a lot of engineers, and if those engineers want to work in a plant where they're actually making things in life sciences, they have to leave the city. And to me, that's unacceptable. And so we built here, and frankly, we're better off for it. And so we may have done things a little bit in an unorthodox fashion, where we had to front load a lot of the risk and a lot of the capital costs of building our own manufacturing, building our own sales team, building our own R&D labs. But we did it, and now the platform that allowed us to deliver Vetigel at that level, it means that the jump from Vetigel to CHG, to our first human product, is not that large at all. It makes it a lot easier so that we're not needing to start all over from scratch.
Nice. So yeah, I've got a bunch of questions as usual, because I'm really excited hearing all this. So I'll start with the least exciting one, which is, like, what's the quantity of Vetigel do you guys produce from that plant that you have now in New York?
So today we produce about 20,000 syringes of Vetigel on a monthly basis for the global market.
And that's
increasing.
Well, that's really good, because obviously with the demand is growing as well, and the popularity of the technology is also increasing as well. And the second part is, I like when you mentioned that you found yourself in a situation where you either had to sink or swim, and you chose to swim. So, mentally, for people also thinking of starting startups and stuff, like, what's the kind of stuff required, you know, in terms of mental fortitude that you need to, you know, to go through this? Do you need a strong team? Do you need to have certain characteristics as part of your personality? Like, what's the secret?
So all of the above, frankly, right? So I think that the most important part is a bit of naivete, right? Yes. You need to be blind enough to the challenges in front of you to be willing to run into a brick wall head first. And then second, most importantly, but very close second, is having a good support system around you. And this is true for all founders of startups. But in my opinion, mental health for founders is not spoken about enough, and it's difficult. A lot of people, you hear the success stories and you see the end result of it. You see the success, you see the happiness, you see a trajectory that looks like it's up and to the right. But in reality, that up and to the right only happened because there were a lot of ups and downs along the way, and typically more downs than ups in the very beginning. And so having that support system where you can understand and have people to lean on and realize that you're not alone fighting against this massive unsolvable problem is critical. And I couldn't be here without my team, without my wife, without my family and friends who help me and support me and make sure that, at the end of the day, when things get hard, that there's still some stability there.
True. No, thank you. That's really a good answer. And I think it's also, I even feel a bit inspired. So I've kind of lost my words there. Then the most exciting question that I had, and everyone's probably wondering that, but how do you raise $100 million for a startup? How do you do that, Joe? And obviously I know you're articulate, so that's one thing I can give you, but I'm sure there's something else. Like, what would you say?
So I think that the most important thing, right, and one of the biggest benefits that we as Cressilon had in the very beginning is that I can put together a 20-second GIF with no audio, no text, that shows you exactly what we do, and you get it, right? We have such a simple concept. The science may be difficult, the regulatory pathway, the risks may be very nuanced, and the use of proceeds may be very nuanced. But at the end of the day, we stop bleeding. And bleeding is bad, and having bleeding stopped quicker is better. And because we were able to distill our entire business down into something that could both show the efficacy of what we do and the magnitude of the problem, it made those investment conversations easier. And I'm not going to say very easy, but it allowed us to do that. And the second thing is allowing yourself to phase out raising capital, where if you raise a seed round, when you raise a seed round, you say, here are the 3 to 5 things that I want to do with this capital. And the best thing you can do is more or less to do those 3 to 5 things about on time. And to show to investors that, and again, most any investor that understands life sciences knows that biology is one of the few things that you can't rush in this world. And so if a test takes 14 days, that test will always take 14 days. You can't throw more money at it and have cells grow faster or something like that. It will still take 14 days. And so when there's an error, you're going to be set back for some time. And so delays are common in this industry, but being upfront, communicating frequently with investors and delivering on what you say you're delivering on, it means that our investors, the vast majority of our investors, have not only invested once, they've invested multiple times throughout the lifespan of our business. I have investors that started investing with us in 2013 and have invested in every single round that we've opened 10 years in.
Well, and from my understanding, you guys are not publicly listed at the moment.
No, we're private.
And the way you have raised the sort of like the capital, do you plan to become a unicorn now? Because obviously at this rate, there's solid confidence that I have that you guys could easily become a unicorn.
So the great thing about being a private company is that we only get to peg our valuation when we go out to raise capital. And at this point, we're not in capital raising mode. And so as a founder that has spent more of my 13 years running this company than otherwise in capital raising mode, it's a nice reprieve from that. But maybe one day.
True. And just one last general question regarding raising capital, because obviously, and I've got an engineering background, just like yourself, Joe. But did you find any differences there that you perhaps would have thought that this would be better being taught in engineering school in terms of helping startups? Know how to raise money. Like, is there any particular jargon you had to learn? any things that you thought could be transferable for people coming from a STEM background? Because I think when it comes to money matters, it's usually the finance guys, right? The guys with the MBAs that seem to know all the language. And what about the rest of us?
Sure. So I love hiring engineers. I mean, frankly, engineers are the most hired background across the entire organization. So that doesn't matter whether we're talking sales or we're talking finance or we're talking engineering itself. We like hiring engineers here at Crestalon because the way that I view it is that when you get an engineering degree, there is, I'd say 90% of what you learn in school, you'll never use again. Right. But what an engineer learns is an engineer learns a process, right? The fundamental of engineering, especially chemical engineering or bioengineering, is that you have a problem that is, or a real world system that is too complicated to distill into a model, right? If you're going to distill bleeding or hemostasis into a system of equations, we'll be here for the next 1,000 years or so, trying to put a system of equations together. And so engineers learn how to be lazy. Right. How to be lazy in a clinical way. And what that means is how do you extract the variables in the system that actually matter? When you're presented with a problem that is too complicated to solve, how do you approximate that problem properly so you can make a problem that's solvable? And most engineering degrees focus on that. And maybe it's not said exactly that way. But if you've gone through an engineering system, right, you understand chemical engineers, we're the worst at this, right? If you have a system you don't know, you draw a box around it, you build a black box, and you just do a mass balance, right? What comes in must equal what comes out. Otherwise, it's getting lost in the box. And if it's getting lost in the box, we can complicate that, but we don't need to know what happens inside of the box. And that's a great mindset for this type of innovation because we're dealing with problem sets that are not exactly modelable in the real world. And so you have to approximate, you have to find ways to solve those problems. And an engineering mindset, in my opinion, is well suited to be able to tackle those challenges.
Nice. Now that's good. I'm happy to hear that. And I'm sure a lot of my audience will be excited to hear that. And then going back to, you know, the CHG, because I think that's really exciting. Was obviously, from what you said, I understand you guys already have an infrastructure that you've already laid out in terms of the foundations from the experience you've gotten with the Vertigo. But now going forward to the CHG in terms of, are you guys really sort of like moving your goalposts a little bit within the company in terms of to accommodate now the new product you're going to be designing? Is it going to be a new product line? Is it going to be potentially a new factory? Like, what does it look like right now in terms of the paperwork for?
So just to highlight the way that we do things, the beauty of CHG is that even though the indication is different, the indication is limited to external minor bleeding, CHG is exactly the Vetigel syringe, and it is exactly the gel in Vetigel. So it requires no new equipment. Now, that being said, we're still gearing up. There are a differing set of validations and paperwork that need to be done in order to bring the CHG manufacturing process into full compliance, and it will take some time before we can bring that product fully to market. But that being said, that this is one of the beauties of starting with our animal health industry is that we've front-loaded most of this work. We've done the validations. We know how to make this product at scale. And then as we look at the next destination, which is Traumagel, our traumatic use product, right? That's a bigger syringe, but it's still the same gel, right? There will be few surprises as we scale because Vetigel today is being used in gunshot wounds. It's being used in stabbings and in motor vehicle accidents, albeit in dogs and cats and whales and dolphins and birds and just about anything else that walks the face of this earth. And so extrapolating that into humans will obviously take additional testing, but it's not the biggest stretch in the world, and we're not exactly going into uncharted territory here.
Nice. And just one thing, just to try to describe, you know, what the Vertigo or CHG potentially looks like. It's, as you showed, it looks like a yellow humus, sort of like honey kind of color. Mm-hmm. But there's an exciting thing though that I saw on a video on YouTube, which I'll be adding it here for it. But I'll try. What happened was when they inserted the gel into the, I think it was a liver that had been dissected and you had blood flowing through it. It sort of like hardened. I don't know if you could simplify that process for us. It's like, you know, you inject it and then it sort of like hardens, changes color a little bit. Is that like a a reaction process, or what exactly is happening at that point?
So what I'll say with that is that I'm not exactly sure what video you're referring to, but if it's the very first video, there's a video that we filmed back in the dorm rooms. It's a very old video.
Yes.
And that was one of the first prototypes of the gel where this is, because the gel was actually thinner, when we first invented it, and we've honed it over the years. And so nowadays, when you use a product like Vetagel or CHG, there's no perceptible color change or phase change in the product. And when I say no perceptible, that's critical there, because there actually is, if you look at the surface, as the gel interacts, the gel will stiffen at the local surface, but so little that you don't actually notice it. And so it happens very subtly, only at the boundary between the gel and the tissue. When we first started, it was a little clunkier, and it's obviously been refined over the last decade or so.
It's quite inspiring to see that journey, because it's like most of the stuff is documented on YouTube. You might find it scattered in different places, but I think one thing that could happen is you could just get maybe an intern or one summer to just create a playlist with all the videos that have been made, you know, since 2013 or so. It'll be quite interesting to see the chain of how the product has developed, which is quite inspiring. But then just coming back then to the CHG, because I'm really excited about it, that's why I probably can't get over it. But I know you say that most of the infrastructure you guys have already had right now, it's like you played chess, you know, you already planned a few moves ahead. So, I mean, when can we expect to have it on the market? I know right now you're still getting that. I know you've been approved now, which is the biggest, you know, thumbs up. But when can we expect it to be on the market, you know, for just people curious? And I know in medtech it can be quite hard to estimate things, because you have to do tests and stuff. But from your own point of view, what would you say regarding that?
Sure. It'll very likely be in the next several months. And so either near the end of this year or early next year is when we're targeting launching. And what I'll say is, personally, when I do a launch, we like to do things the right way. And so if that comes at the expense of taking a little bit of extra time to do it the right way, then so be it. It matters that the customer, that the patient has a good experience with the product as we launch. And so we need to make sure that everything is done properly and ready to go before we actually open up the floodgates.
Nice. And do you have a sort of like a commercialization plan? Because I know most people will be listening to this. They've got like a sort of like a STEM background. But in terms of your plan to commercialize the product, is there certain things you could tell us or regarding that?
So the unique thing about CHG is that actually, and maybe this is an interesting point to discuss, that CHG is not the biggest market that we're entering, right? And so the value for Cresilon primarily in CHG is not because we wanted to commercialize a product that stops minor bleeding, but because it sets a predicate for an additional cohort of 510Ks that we're planning on submitting. And so the most important thing is now we have FDA clearance on our gel for an indication. And that indication may not be the most exciting, it may not be the most profitable, it may not be the most life-saving, but it means that for every application from this point forward that Cresilon submits, we will be able to use this initial application as our predicate. Or at least just one of the predicates. And so it drastically improves our ability to bring the next product to market faster. And so there's some exciting news that I can't exactly speak about right now. But as we look at where things go in the future, what we see is that CHG is really that jumping off point to allow us to commercialize into the next indication as quickly as we can. And so when we do bring CSG to market, it will likely be limited, just because, in my opinion, CSG will be followed by products that have much more much larger addressable markets and much more drastic benefits over standard of care to the end user and to the clinician.